Well, that gives you a clue as to where I am, doesn't it? Well, let's just take a minute and pray. You don't need to stand again. God can hear us even if you're sitting down. Our Father, thank you for the opportunity to be together this evening. Your grace is sufficient for every need that we have, and your strength has been made perfect in weakness down through the years. How grateful we are that you are God and that we are your children and that we can be here tonight to fellowship together and to look into such a pertinent subject as the one that is online. Grant that your wisdom may be imparted. We thank you for John and for bringing him here, and ask that you will magnify yourself through him to us, and then through us to others. In Christ's name, amen. A lot of years ago, there was an older pastor in the district who enjoyed chiding younger pastors. But he did that kind of on the side. And you had to learn to know that behind the chiding, there was always an encouraging and steady hand that would be there to guide. James Dittmar was a great inspiration and a very, very good friend of mine. But he had some sons, and I've learned to know the sons as well. John Dittmar is affiliated with the Latrobe Hospital Mental Health Program. He directs the student. Yes, what was that again, John? I wrote it down. I can't read it.
Student assistant.
Yes, now I can read it. The student assistant program. He is a therapist with the drug and alcohol program, and he is currently a doctoral candidate at Weldon University in Weldon, Minnesota. But more than all of that, John is a human being and a Christian one and a good friend of mine and a person to whom I have turned many, many times. Some of you may very well remember that many years ago, when John was early in his career, he used to come once a week here to work with our children who were struggling with emotional problems. And he's been here with his wife, who is also a certified psychologist working out of Latrobe Hospital, to just share an evening service back when we had the four programs once a month. Remember, we would break down into focus groups, the adults and the men and the women and children and the youth. Well, John was here for that one time, and we had a great time with him. Now he's come to talk to us about the subject of depression. John, are you going to talk anything about the statistics on depression this evening?
I can make some up.
Well, isn't that what they do anyhow? There is a clear problem, an increasing problem in our country and probably throughout the world with depression. And there's what's known as early onset depression, depression in children, depression in adolescents, depression in adults, and depression in senior adults. So depression is a real problem that many of us experience, and if we don't experience it personally, we are related or involved with people who do experience it personally. So John is going to come, and he's going to stand down here in front, not behind the pulpit, to talk. But I want you to know, John, for a long time, was an elder in the Alliance Church, and then he backslid and became a Presbyterian. And
a Lutheran.
Maybe. That may even be worse. Oh, dear, I thought it was Presbyterian. I could accept the Presbyterian. Well, I'll accept
you.
You
want me to leave?
No. Now, isn't it wonderful that we can mingle with many denominations, knowing that we have one Christ who was at the center of them all? John, come and talk to us, would you?
Okay, I might be on now or I might not be. Okay. You know, you were talking about my father, someone who chided, and I remember when my father passed away. He was an Alliance pastor, and he had retired from the church in Lower Burrell, and it was a great send off, as they would say in the Alliance, for him. And certainly we were comfortable with his passing. But I remember someone getting up and going on and on about his sense of humor, and then my brother Jim gets up and says something like, "Well, you never lived with the man." Actually, his chiding was wonderful for us as children. Both my parents had a sense of humor, and just by looking at us, they had to, I think, to kind of get through things. But we really, throughout our lifetime, have always been grateful for the heritage that our family's given us. We still go to Mahaffey. A number of talk of trash again on the family. My oldest brother, also not in the Alliance right now, but wrote an article about going to Mahaffey for the witness a few years ago. If you remember, there was a series of articles about church camp, and then there was a story about a young man who told that he was sitting in a pew with his mother and younger brother. The younger brother was acting up, but it was communion time during that service. And as the tray was coming down, the younger brother grabbed for it, and my mother said, "No, you can't." The mother said, "No, you can't have that. You have to be saved." And of course, this is my family. Jim, who's the middle brother, said, "Well, I want to be saved right now." And my oldest brother, Sam, turned to him in a good Alliance fashion and says, "No, you have to wait to go to Mahaffey to do that." So there is a great heritage, and we do share that. It is wonderful. And as I've moved throughout the years, throughout church and denomination, you certainly find that to be true, that God's grace is all sufficient. And won't we be surprised when we're in heaven and we look around and we see that there are not just Alliance people, there might even be a few Baptists and a few Lutherans, or at least I'm hoping one here. The song that we've sung tonight, I thought, was especially appropriate because it speaks about this hope that we have. And when we talk about our lives and the things that can go wrong, remember that we are creatures who have fallen, not just from grace, but in other ways. And the infirmities that we have can all be attributed to sin. But our hope in our salvation certainly doesn't rest solely on our conduct, because if it would, I believe that we would all stand short. In fact, in Romans it says that none of us can stand the test, but that God's grace covers everything. And particularly when you look in the area of behavior and mental illness, sometimes it's hard to distinguish that, to understand how can God be working in someone's life when they're suffering or seemingly making terrible choices time and time again. And all I say is that, again, the grace of God is sufficient. And we can be thankful for that. We certainly need to be encouraged in the way that we live our lives, that we improve. But understand that throughout society, throughout a Christian population, there's a percentage of people that will suffer some sort of mental illness during their lifetime, in the same way you might have pneumonia through a certain percentage. There are other maladies that occur. It's just with mental health issues, sometimes we sort of move into an area where that person is unclean or unhealthy. And I think that's a misconception that doesn't appear so much anymore, but I remember as a young man growing up that the first order of business was get your house right with the Lord and that will go away. And I don't believe that to be true. And I don't mean to as the president would say, to be misunderestimated or misunderstood. I don't want to offend anyone by that, but I want you to understand, from my perspective, this is a malady just like anyone else, anything else, that should not, at its bottom line, be viewed as affecting our relationship with the Lord. You know, you try to find in the Bible, and when you think about it, you know, who in the Bible has, I mean, some of our most wonderful characters that we esteem so highly were really pretty much reprobates. You know, David, a murderer, a philandering murderer. Abraham, you know, really didn't take good care of his wife at times. It's, oh, sure, she's just my sister. Go ahead and marry her. I'll be okay. I mean, and yet these are the fathers of our faith. And Paul speaks to this and these, you know, errors in judgment and then other things that go on in his life. And certainly he said he struggled with sin throughout his whole life. But in particular, he talks about what's been speculated as this thorn in his side. What was this? And in 2 Corinthians, I'll just read quickly, to keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassing great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. Power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. Now, again, we don't know what that is in particular, but obviously Paul made it very clear. The Lord wasn't going to step in every situation and magically, and I don't mean magic in an irreverent way, but take that burden away. We thought it might be depression. Gee, he seems what they used to call manic depressive. Now we call him bipolar. You know, he's hot one minute and cold the next. We don't know what that was. But again, God speaks to him and says, my grace is sufficient, I think, in terms of his soul and his spiritual being and not necessarily the human aspects of his life, his physical and mental well-being. Anybody in here, and I want to just sort of lay the groundwork with behavior. Anybody in here an outdoorsman of any sort? Just the two of us? Three? When you walk in the woods, any of you, where do you walk? On a path. Very simple. It's the, you know, why don't you walk through the middle of, you know, the thickest part? It's just too difficult. And our behavior, we're finding out more and more scientifically, is created in the same fashion. Pathways are worn. Behavior becomes easier as it becomes repeated over time. Let's see. Who could be my first victim? You seem to be an unsortly type here. You don't care about my self-esteem, do you? Okay. For supper tonight, did I stop at Sheetz and get a salad? No, just by looking at me. Or did I stop at McDonald's and get that double quarter pounder with cheese? No, just by looking at me, what would you say? Go ahead. Wail away. Oh, but I'm making it your business. I'm asking you. You look ornery enough. Do I look like a salad eater, or do I look like a double quarter pounder with cheese, supersize those friends? Why? You look at me, and I don't look like I bear the burden of an addiction to salads. No way. Early on in my life, I learned cheeseburger good when I was hungry, salad bad. And when given a choice, I followed that pathway. You know, it started out innocently. You know, the Hamburglar, the dad pastor to McKees Rocks, you know. Hamburglar came up to me, hey, kid, try one of these. And McDonald's, you know, just took over my life. And from that point on, I learned that cheeseburgers would satisfy my needs in a way that salads never could. Now, there are probably people in here that raised there would say, I prefer salads. You know, you're the type of people I see running along the roads in the morning, looking in such pain and anguish, while I'm driving to McDonald's to get an Egg McMuffin for breakfast. See, behavior makes sense. And we find out that from a very early age, we look for means of to satisfy our needs that become pretty common and regular for us, almost as if it becomes second nature. We don't really think about it sometimes. I don't know what was happening, honey. I was just driving the car, and magically, next thing I knew, I was at the drive-thru. What was I supposed to do? You know, she's not happy about that. Because now I know that the behavior doesn't make sense. I have two little children. I have a 7-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son. And, you know, you'd think I would want to be physically fit all the time. And I do. I really do. But behavior is hard to change. Because it's sort of like my brains are like the woods. I follow the path when presented with the opportunity. And they're actually finding this out now. And in Pittsburgh, at Western Psychiatric Hospital, along with Carnegie Mellon University, they're studying through the use of what's called functional MRIs. You've heard of an MRI examination, magnetic resonance imaging. And I forget, does it pick up on the, is it the glucose or is it the electric? I forget what it is. I think it's the electric pathways. But they're actually, with this functional MRI, able to, in that instant, follow the track of a response to a stimuli. So if you put somebody sitting in a chair or wherever they are in the imaging machine, and you show them a picture, that there's sort of a reaction to it, that they're able to map now sort of tendencies for behavior. It's remarkable. And they're doing it primarily with addictions now, where if you put, a can of beer or something in front of someone who's an alcoholic, it will show immediately in real time the pathways for that. It's remarkable then when you look at any aspect of our behavior, how through repetition we've created these things and in a sense have normalized our behavior, where just about everything we do makes sense to us. It makes sense for me to go to McDonald's. It's not right, but it makes sense to me. And I don't imagine anybody here has ever looked at somebody else and sort of scratched their heads like, what in the world were they thinking when they did that? There's an undercurrent of chuckles, that chiding thing I think you were talking about before. Sure. That, we have that understanding that we sort of are the golden mean. We're sort of the one that establishes what's right and wrong and what makes sense for us. Now, those are some basic things about behavior. Add the spiritual realm, it really gets out of there. Because many years ago, and even to some degree now, there's an idea that these behavior patterns should somehow be changed immediately when we consider the grace of God, and that if it doesn't, so-and-so, it's not so much struggling with sin, they're living in sin, they're, all kinds of things, and particularly when you add mental health into the package, it's so hard because these are diseases that affect that pathway of thought, however that is done in the brain. When you consider depression, and I imagine in this size of a congregation or a gathering here tonight, people have known folks that have suffered genuine mental illness. Most common would be depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, maybe disorders that related to psychotic kind of behavior, schizophrenics and others, who are just not able to process information correctly. Understand that what we're learning now chemically is that there's a disruption of that process. And I know I don't mean to be graphic just for the sake of being graphic, but to tell someone who's depressed, quit thinking about being depressed, or if you're anxious, quit thinking about it and move on, is like telling somebody who has diarrhea, don't think about going to the bathroom. That's as graphic and as I can make it. It's just impossible because of what we know now about how the mind works chemically to create these pathways. When I look at how depression is treated now, there are two elements that are really important. The first is, as a Christian, when I talk with someone who I know is a Christian about their depression, the first question, or the early on in the process, someone will say, you know, if I just had enough faith. And my first job, as I see it, is to counteract that and say, this has nothing to do with your faith in God. If you believe that God saves you, you know, the price has already been paid. What you have to ask, anyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. I said, the pathway is very simple. You can be protected. Christ is still described as sort of the attorney before the judge, pleading our case day in and day out. That is never questioned. But there are two other things then that have to occur. First is we're going to treat an illness. If you had pneumonia, there's a certain course of treatment that's required. If you're diabetic, there's a certain protocol that you follow to take care of things. And in the same way, with a mental health problem, the procedure should be much the same. One of the most marvelous things that God has allowed man to understand about the mind is the chemicals that go into making for healthy minds. There's a whole category of treatments now for depression, for anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder that are labeled SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Remember that. You'll be tested on it, so those of you that are writing. Have you ever seen the Zoloft commercial on TV? And there's sort of like this drop that's moving through the world and it's happy, sad. But there's one little explanation where it shows how things are moving from one area to another in the brain. And I'm doing this because this is how the image is. If you look at one brain cell, you have these little cavities here called receptors. And the gap between two brain cells is called a synapse. And if you don't have enough of the right chemicals, or you have too many of some chemicals, that process of communication is disrupted. And again, going back to the pathway, all of a sudden something changes. And even though it started back here, for some reason along the way, you know, that functional MRI wouldn't show it going to all the places that it would need to go. It's interrupted. Just like construction on a highway. It's a lot easier when the highway's clear. But if you have problems, you have to take detours. Essentially, that's what your mind is doing when there are not the chemicals in place. SSRIs are the first, but there are also three other types that are out there. I shouldn't say SSRIs are the first, but they are the most commonly used right now to treat depression. Serotonin is an important chemical in brain cell communication. And essentially, if you have enough serotonin going back and forth between these two brain cells, your mood is pretty regulated. Generally, you're happy. If you're, for some reason, not able to produce enough, the system breaks down. Decision-making becomes difficult. You don't want to get out of bed. You don't want to do the simple things that you were able to do just a few weeks ago. And it's that important. And again, the marvelous thing that they found is with a specific type of medicine, and there are like 59 of these right now, that impact directly on this level of serotonin in the brain. If any of you know a little bit about brain physiology, we have the brain stem right here coming up, and then in the back is the cerebellum, and that's primarily where serotonin is made. And if you would imagine the cerebellum is like the conductor at a big rail yard. You know, it takes all the information in and then moves it out to where it's supposed to go. And in our case, the images come through our senses, you know, eyes, ears, touch. It's processed back here and then moved out to where it needs to go. Well, if the cerebellum isn't working, you can imagine how that impacts on people. You know, it's not just someone who has a dreary disposition, but someone who's not capable of just picking up. And it's painful almost to just walk and do the things again that maybe just a few weeks ago they were able to do. There is a difference between depression and grief. All of us have experienced grief. And we've experienced those times when it feels like all we have to do is just, you know, hang in there and, you know, 5 or 6 months we'll know that we're better. You can even be optimistic in the middle of grief. But the same thing happens physiologically. When there's a blow to the mind and the heart, temporarily serotonin production is shut down. Which is why when you go to a funeral home, you know, you'll see a broad range of emotion there. Some of it seems inappropriate. You know, I made the comment about when my dad passed away. My mom had died about 12 years before. And my brothers and I still comment that when are we going to grieve Dad? None of us have. You know, and people, and I want to say that in a negative way, we just were completely comfortable with him passing away. With my mom, it was different. I can remember the pain standing by her casket and thinking, man, I just wish it was 6 months from now because I know that I'd feel better. But I was experiencing the same thing there as somebody who would initially experience some depression. There is a shutdown. I couldn't make decisions. I was weepy. I was elated. I was, again, thinking about the funeral home. You know, as you visit with people you haven't seen in a while, you can imagine an Alliance pastor and the churches that my dad had pastored, people coming in. It was wonderful and painful all at the same time. The difference with grief is that there is this idea of momentum that moves forward. With depression, there's not an element of time that allows for healing because something is happening to the cerebellum. It's not producing what it needs to, and it needs help. Statistics will show that people that are involved with counseling and with medicine after a year's time, it's almost as high as 90-95%, will say their symptoms have lifted. You know, you might say that it's going to be very high if nothing is done. Well, that's probably true because, remember, there's a physiological thing going on that disrupts the creation of serotonin. I don't know if anybody here has ever been on an Atkins diet, but they tell you to watch your carbs. What happens if you don't have enough carbs or the series of B vitamins? It affects the cerebellum and your mood. And there are a lot of people that have experienced irritability, you know, or even depression or anxiety because they weren't getting enough simple carbohydrates. And I can think of several people that I've worked with that they've experienced that, and that's been in part what's going on. So again, this is relating to a physiological need, not a spiritual need. Something's happening back here. So we have these medicines that help. And people that utilize medicines, you know, see results. It's proven. And again, with this area of need, mental health, with depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, they all sort of work together. If you think about it, people that become anxious or focused on something inappropriately, in the same way if you were obsessed with, you know, not wanting to get your hands dirty, or depressed where you're just not able to focus beyond the pain that you're feeling right now. They sort of go together, and they're treated with the same type of drugs. And it does make a difference. I can remember a young man that I talked with who was very successful, was a go-getter in his business, was gone wonderfully with his work and with his personal life. Out of the blue, just couldn't get out of bed. His wife was like, I don't know what's happened to him. She thought he was unhappy in the marriage. He's looking for answers. And so in talking with him, encouraged him to consider this idea of taking some medicine. Because I couldn't establish that
gee, this is probably you were potty trained incorrectly. I think that you certainly, you know. No, there was just no reason for it. So he was involved in counseling to encourage him to say, you know, here's how it's going to be better. Here's how things are going to move forward for you eventually. You're going to have those feelings back. So it sort of became motivational, not so much an idea of him going through that introspection, you know, finding out why he was potty trained the way he was and obviously how that affected him now. There was no connection. And then the medicine. And 6 or 8 weeks later, I remember him describing, it was like a cloud lifted. He said, I just woke up one morning, and it was like, I look back at my pain from just a day or two ago, and I couldn't understand why I was thinking that way. In the same way, when I was sick, I couldn't even imagine being able to go out on a call, business-wise, and be successful. I just didn't have the self-confidence. Again, a physiological need was met. And the counseling just provided the encouragement to hang in there. This stuff will work. When we look at how people are going to be treated in the future, much of the same kind of thing is going to occur. And I hope not indiscriminately, because again, if people are grieving, or with time we all have mood, bad days, the clouds are out, you know, it's raining, the Steelers didn't beat the Eagles today. You know, those kinds of things would make us glum for a few days. We've all experienced that. But when people are medically ill with this, there's a great hope that they can be treated and not carry the spiritual baggage that sometimes is associated with this, that if you could just pray hard enough. And I'm not trying to mock anyone who did that approach, because I truly believe in prayer. Does God heal? Yes. I say that individually myself. I remember one night being in such emotional pain, and this was over a relationship, that I just couldn't see myself, mate, how am I going to go on? And I thought I had worked through this, and another event occurred, and Sunday night I'm sitting in a pew in the back seat where any good pastor's kid would sit, in the very back pew. And my dad was preaching that night, and I don't even know what he talked about. But I said, and he wasn't even going to have an altar call. It was more like a Bible study. And he was just singing a song. It might have even been like, I don't know. It certainly wasn't a just as I am type of, you know, hang in there for one more verse, or, you know, every head bow, eyes closed thing. No, this was just sort of a wrap up. And I said, I'm going to walk down. And I just felt the need to do it. And my dad, I can still remember the look on his face, like, what in the world's going on here, kid? I'll talk to you about it later. Don't embarrass me. No, no. But I came up, and I kneeled at the altar, and he came down and called one of the elders over and said, John, what can I do? I said, it's taken care of. He says, well, what do you mean? You don't need to pray. It's taken care of. Well, we're here. I said, okay, if you and Mr. Mahaffey want to pray, go ahead. From the time I left the back of that church to the front, I can say that that cloud lifted. The pain that I felt back in that pew, I've never felt again. Since that time, and it was wonderful. It just was completely unexpected. I know that I was depressed as I looked. They're certainly grieving terribly. I was a mess. It just changed. And just my dad just couldn't figure out, what the heck's going on? What do you mean you don't have to pray? You came up here. So it's taken care of, Dad, trust me. Since that time, I've wished for that same kind of healing. This goes back 25 years. I was in college going to a roommate's wedding that I was going to participate in Iowa. On the return journey, I'm flying from Des Moines to O'Hare. I had experienced, along with how many ever hundreds of passengers were in that plane, what's called an incident, an FAA incident. We didn't crash, but it was horrible. And there were experienced people on that plane, far more than me, that just, you know, we were all thankful that we made it. I had to fly from O'Hare then to Pittsburgh out of those same thunderstorms that night. I didn't realize it, but Pastor Wood, you actually can hold a plane up by gripping tightly enough on the armrests. For 20 years, I never flew. I actually was in one of those aluminum tubes and sat down and said to my fiance, because her family lived in Texas, my wife now, I can't do this, and walked out of the plane. And that was 6 weeks before we were to get married. Whew. I mean, you talk about tension. It didn't go away. I prayed for it the same way. You know, I thought I, you know, would have this thing lived. But you know what? It required the same practical things that I've asked many people to do. Now, I will never be, a test pilot for NASA. But this year, I don't know. Anybody here ever watch KDK TV? In the summer, there was a hurricane that hit Fort Myers. I don't know if you remember hearing that, called Charlie. My in-laws have a condo in Fort Myers, and I was indeed evacuated from Fort Myers. By this time, I've flown like 3 or 4 times. Coming back, we landed at Pittsburgh, and I'm at the gate at the carousel, and this guy from KDK had a camera, so he tapped me and said, when you get your bags, that woman over there said that you could give a statement about what it's like to be in the hurricane. And I said, what woman? And it's my wife. And, of course, I said, why not you? She said, well, you know, the power was out. I didn't have my makeup on. My hair wasn't, you know. So there was myself and my children were viewed on camera. And some friends that I hadn't had contact with for a while saw that. This was, in case you're interested and you want to go back and ask KDK for the archives, I'm sure it's a wonderful piece that you'd all want to have. It was the night that the Steelers were playing Detroit in the preseason. So it was on before the game. It was also on after. I didn't know that until later. But I had one of these old friends call up and said, what the heck were you doing giving that interview at the airport? Because his last recollection of me was running out of the tube. And I explained to him, here's what I did. You know, I did relaxation. I practiced. I thought about it. I prayed. I would have worn Depends if that would have been required. But I said, through the grace of God, been able to do it. When the pastor also mentioned about my schooling now, the University Walden, you're wondering, how in the heck is he going to school in Minnesota? Minnesota, as they say, living in Latrobe. But the fact is, I have to travel quite a bit to Fort Myers this winter, which is interesting enough. 6 times for 2 weeks in March. That'll really be hard. I've already told my neighbors, please go over, be nice to her if the nor'easter hits. When I'm down in, you know, warm, sunny Florida in March, I'm going to need a lot of help to come back and not be, you know, slaughtered by my wife. But you know what I got in the mail the other day? A frequent flyers card. How did it happen? I just am reworking those pathways. Because we all know, in reality, it's safer to fly down there than to drive. Still something about if my engine, you know, knocks out, I can pull off the road. But if I'm at 30,000 feet, that you don't have the same sort of options. But in all likelihood, I'm going to be fine. In fact, safer. But that connect was not always there because of one bad experience. And that's all that counseling is asking us to do at different times, is to think about reshaping pathways that are learned. When you look at how people sometimes will settle with things or do certain things in their lives that just scratch your head, why would you do that again? You know, I work with adult populations many times, and I work with clients now that may be involved with the legal system because of DUI charges or drug and alcohol charges, otherwise drug possessions and sales. You know, you go, you say, why in the world, what were you thinking? You know, what was the thought that started it? And you know what? It's a different world. I drive by the office and there's this big Coors beer sign up there. It means nothing to me. If I'm an alcoholic or someone who thinks that it's Steeler Sunday, better have an iron or two with me, or it's just not right. You don't feel comfortable. You have to really work to kind of get people to see that, you know, there's another way to live. There's a whole bunch of people out there who don't drink, who don't do these kinds of things. And it's just through practice and understanding very practical things. This in combination, and why I relate it so importantly to depression, is that we are understanding that from an early age, when someone has this propensity for this lack of serotonin, it doesn't just appear necessarily suddenly. Many times it happens that throughout the course of someone's life, they've been affected by this. And it's going to shape the way they look and interpret things that go on around. You know, they're going to look at it through these eyes, and those pathways are real problems because it's almost like they're expecting of themselves to act depressed. And you just sort of have to rework that circuitry, create new pathways. I say that for me to do this work, you know, I'm not that bright. And I know that you said that, didn't you, again? I heard you murmur. I'm not the brightest bulb in the pack. It's really connecting the dots when I, you know, it's like, okay, we have this behavior here that wasn't very bright. Let's kind of work back and figure out, you know, why is it that I don't like salads? Well, maybe in discussions with you, I share that, you know, I was attacked by a giant stalk of celery when I was 3. And ever since then, I've been frightened of the vengeance of the healthy garden vegetables and what they might do to me. And you can say, well, John, I truly believe that that happened. But, you know, typically, you're safe around tomatoes. You know, you can, and all of a sudden, this light bulb goes off and the process can change. I don't have to have that same reaction. So there is a practical element that still is required. Sometimes that does bring in a spiritual realm to this, where it's, if you're committed to change for the betterment of your life, know that you have got to work honestly at putting into place the things that make it easier for you to follow a pathway that you would say is one that's more spiritual, more godly, more Christ-like. But that's after the fact. And that's certainly, even of that, I can't judge whether or not someone's going to go into heaven. I don't have that ability. I can certainly encourage them to do that. But I make it a matter then, at that point in time. If you believe in your heart that this is a better way to be a husband, to be a father, a wife, a mother, if you put it before the Lord, you're going to be challenged. And we know the changing power of God's grace, because we've experienced it personally, or we know of people who just 180 degrees. The old stuff is gone. But it doesn't always happen that way. But when it does, it just confirms what we know. And we can pray, we can reach out, we can do all kinds of things to just help ourselves sort of want to move forward in our on our walk with the Lord. But in this one area, we need to understand with mental health, so much of what's happened is something that's happened from not just events, but just what was happening physically years ago in a young person's life. And that our job, my job, is to help them sort of develop the new pathways, understand that there are new ways of intervention besides just prayer, which is still important, but there are other things that you can do. And as far as you, you know, the power in relationships is significant. If I was to ask any of you, who are the people that made a difference in your life about anything? You know, you probably could name 2 or 3, some of whom have no idea that they ever impacted you that way. But they were like somebody who modeled the right kind of behavior or who encouraged you. I mean, the remarkable thing about being a minister's son is just you were able to see people in all the churches that they were the ones that were so dependable. Every time the doors were open, a need was brought forward, they were there to respond in some way. They weren't the brightest people. They weren't the richest people, but they were certainly the stalwarts. And many of those couples or parents or peers continue to have influence on me, and they'll never know, you know, what they've meant to me. I still remember, and I'll end with this, a young man, he was probably in his early 20s at the time, who was my first experience outside of my father of a good Christian man who was a man's man. He was an athlete. I mean, he was gifted in a lot of ways, but he also led the Sunday school warming or opening exercises. Charlie is the one that taught me how to fly over the enemy, march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry. You remember that? And I fortunately have had the chance to tell him that. I said, you will always be with me because you gave me a representative of it's okay to be this way when it comes to Christ. And you're still a man of respect. You're not a wimp, you know. And that kind of an influence and encouragement can cross a lot of different areas and a lot of different needs. That's just one in my life. And I've had the good fortune of meeting so many. I know we have a few minutes left here. I know you said originally you wanted me to be here for 3 hours, but I didn't think we were at the Black Pentecostal Church down the way. But I don't know if anybody has any questions or any other thoughts or whatever. I certainly... Yes?
I have a question.
As best that they're doing is with these functional MRIs. Understand that there are millions of chemicals between there. This is just one of them, but they've been fortunate enough to find it. It's usually found in the symptoms. If somebody shows anxiousness or depression and then they respond to treatment, that's the best indicator. But there's not like a blood serum test to go through there and look at that.
Well, I guess with that, then, how do you prescribe these prescriptions to people, you know, if they will produce the right level of
serotonin? Well, with that, again, through studies that have been done, they found, you know, certain ranges of medicine, maybe some based on weight or other kinds of things, should have an impact. And with most SSRIs, and those type of medicines, you're looking at a 3 to 4 week frame of time before you even begin to see any clinical benefit. So it is sort of a guess initially. And it might not work. And then they try one of the other 58. It's not that clear cut, but when you're on medicine that's appropriate and helpful, you know, you can relate that to a physician and say, you know, this is, you know, I'm feeling better. You know, and that's usually, okay, this is what we need to maintain. But that's just with, you know, clinical studies. Yes? Is that the skin? There's another chemical in the brain, though. Is it Melaril that I'm thinking of? I'm not sure, but I think that there is a... I don't know that that has to do with depression. And there is an M one. There's dopamine, serotonin, ephedrine. But I'm not sure about that one. I know that there's sort of like an herb out there that talks about that.
Doesn't melatonin have to do with sleep?
It might. I think it's just being, you know, identified more easily. One thing that's happening, and I got to tell you, I was initially sort of, you know, taken back by this. I mentioned the manic depressive, which is now bipolar. You know, about 15 years ago, doctors were going crazy identifying kids as attention deficit disorder and throwing amphetamines at them, Ritalin and some others. And it wasn't working. What they're finding now, and again, Western Psych is kind of leading the way on this, is that they are discovering that young children as young as 5 or 6 that are treated for bipolar respond to the medicine that's prescribed. It's sort of like their anticonvulsant drugs that they typically use. and that they're responding with, and it sort of it calms their mood or it stabilizes. You know, they're not as out of control. Whereas before, they just thought the kid wasn't able to pay attention. He was, I mean, the chemical balances in his brain were so off that he just wasn't able to manage his emotions in any way. The real benefit in that, and I was sort of taken aback by this. I'm like, how can you do this? But when I saw the responses that some of these children were showing, I was thinking, you know, imagine if you felt like you were crazy for the first 15 or 20 years of your life, and they said, well, we're not going to treat this till you're 17 or 18. You know, there's a lot of those pathways that have been etched in place. And now children are given an opportunity. I'm not one that says, you know, we need on every occasion to throw medicine at it. But it really is amazing how sometimes kids can respond. For me, and I'm not a physician in any way, but I used to tell parents, you know, Ritalin usually works like that. You know, if you know anybody who's in education, they can tell which kids forgot to take the medicine that morning. If they have truly attention deficit disorders. Others, it just doesn't, there's not a pill big enough that's going to make a dent. And now I'm thinking that those kids are the ones that are probably fitting these other categories that might be able to be treated better.
Once there's been a depressive episode, is there an increased percentage that it will reoccur?
Yes, if somebody, has had the question was about is there a reoccurrence of that? And they basically say now that 10 to 15% of the population at any given time might be depressed. And it's certainly higher for those people to have a reoccurrence because, again, this is a physical problem. If you've had a heart attack once, you're liable to have another heart attack unless you take certain measures. And so that's what's kind of required. It used to be that if people were involved in counseling and medicine, that it just sort of went on for a year. And then nothing more was done. Well, now they're finding out that at least if there's some sort of level of medicine that's maintained, the opportunity for reoccurrence is pretty low. The counseling isn't so much important, but the medicine is.
Can you get people to take a medication for a long period of time? Do you ever find that that no longer works for a person?
There is a phenomenon like that they just don't know why, but sometimes it loses its effectiveness. It might be that it was really not the specific kind of medicine they needed in the first place, but it was helpful. Again, I go back to the fact that there are 59 of these SSRIs, and they each have a different blending of things. And like I said, there's other chemicals in there that their presence or their lack of presence can have an impact. So it's really important to get the right one. They shouldn't be on more than one. There might be some that have another type, like some have sort of they're anti-convulsants, and so sometimes they sort of impact on other features. Sometimes people, when they get depressed, they sort of kind of become psychotic, and they have delusions or hallucinations and things like that. So sometimes the medicine goes along with that. Or sometimes things like Wellbutrin is also used for adult attention deficit disorder. I wonder if there's a drug there for the problem I'm having with pronunciation. So sometimes, and that's also used in treatment for just that. But I mean, I'm not a doctor, but that's like, you know, if you have a headache, you take a Tylenol, but you don't necessarily take a Tylenol, aspirin, and a Motrin all at the same time. So, but don't take that to the bank, you know, because I'm just a peon.
It seems that in these times that there's a lot of talk about the fact that doctors prescribe medications basically to cover over the symptoms, whereas you have a thought that coming from the naturalist side of herbal-type medicines let's get to the root cause of the problem as opposed to taking something that was just masked over.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's really two things to consider. One is my wife works for La Trobe Hospital as well. She works with an adult population.
the primary referral source for her are family physicians that are associated with La Trobe Hospital, because someone's coming in and complaining about being depressed, and those doctors now are more comfortable managing some, a patient's medicine, but they still recognize that there's a need for some work here. So again, then they're involved with a therapist going through and looking at some of those other things that might not necessarily be root causes, but patterns of behavior that set up depression. You know, maybe for me the lifestyle change is that I have to find a way to get from here to La Trobe where there's not a McDonald's. So I have to go back, you know, into Hermony and some other way. I mean, that's sort of a silly approach, but that's the way some of the work has to be done to prevent a possible continuing problem. But if you look at this as just a behavior problem, you know, you're going to lose people. They're going to be very discouraged because someone who's genuinely depressed and mentally ill, they can't will themselves out of this. And it is so discouraging for people who are, you know, gifted and talented in so many ways. Again, I go back to the example before. I manage 35 people in a business. Why can't I do this? I mean, it was just so discouraging for him. So, you know, there really does need to be a balance. And I'm not one to say, you know, the first answer is always medicine. But when appropriate, it can bring about dramatic results. In some instances, there might be, like where grief is not resolved, that there might have been an undercurrent of, you know, someone is sort of predisposed. Family histories are important, you know, that this is something that's passed along that oftentimes will show up. But there doesn't have to be a precipitating factor. It can just sort of, for some reason, occur. You know, like I said, the Atkins or low carbs, it can happen. You know, just that it was time in that person's life that their serotonin was used up.
Can you rebuild the serotonin?
Oh, yeah. Well, what the medicine does is it really does provide an ability for the body to get back up to normal amounts. And if you go back to this example, what normally happens is as this brain cell would communicate with this, there's a natural level of absorption of that chemical that goes across there. What happens with people that don't have enough serotonin is they can't afford the loss. So what a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor does is it allows for that to go over, and it's sort of like it's not coated, but it's just not absorbed. It's allowed to sit there and communicate, but then it sort of drifts back into the middle, and it's able to be used again, and it's not it's not taken back. So over time, the body will have enough. But if you look at this as a physical problem, you know, just because I've had a shot of insulin today, I'm a diabetic, I've got to continue to do that because it's going to be used up. So oftentimes the levels of medicine that people are on to continue are pretty low dosages or moderate dosages.
I was on two antidepressants for maybe 14, 15 months.
Wow.
And I only started to really feel better when I got a different doctor and went on everything. And then that's when I felt like the cloud lifted for me, was when I was on absolutely nothing. But what I did want to say was to echo that there are things that people can say to you at this time which are not at all. And there are people who love you very
Yeah.
And take care of your baby, which is what you want to do more mm-hmm. than anything else. But for some reason, you just can't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, all you want to do is, like you said, is be in your bed under your mm-hmm. covers, which was never my pattern before. Yeah. But for that 14 or 15 months, you know, it just took me a long time. But and I'm starting to ramble, and I don't want to.
No.
Get rid of them and get another one. Because I had a psychiatrist who never did anything for me other than say, do you need your prescriptions refilled?
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. But it was new to me.
Yeah.
Now I would know and say, get rid of that person and find somebody else.
Yeah, I think the first thing is, on a practical level, to be a consumer. And if you're, you know, somebody asked before about the numbers, you know, of medicines. You know, there's a period of time when these should become effective in some way. What they're finding just sort of, offhandedly, is that the causes for postpartum depression, there's more response to some hormonal treatments, because you can imagine the whole process of the growth of the baby, the changes that you go through physically, that's what they're finding more of. Although people do respond to the boost of SSRIs, that's been the course of treatment, but that's changing. And again, just a short-term kind of approach that, you know, we're going to include, you know, hormones at this. As far as what anyone can do, I can't imagine anyone to be discouraged by a hug. I mean, I've never been offended. I've been sort of like put off, but I think when someone sort of reads me appropriately, you know, and I'm not a touchy-feely guy, but, you know, most people like that. You know, how hard is it to encourage someone? Just that it's nice to see you here today without any other sort of, you know, it's been 6 weeks we've noticed since you've been in, you know, here, but it's just nice to see you here. There are those gestures, and any of us can attest to that at times when, you know, people wanted to be so helpful. And again, I go back to why I do this. I am not that bright. I'm not a rocket scientist. But there are ways for any of us to just say, you know, I think you're going to be okay. Can I help with anything? We don't have to have the answers to all of a sudden just, you know, make the heavens open up. When I, with my work in the schools, I'm called to go in when there's a tragedy, a death of a student or a faculty member that impacts on the community. And so I go in, and many times these kids are coming in the first time they've ever experienced grief. And they're waiting for me to say something magic. And I say, this is not going to go away, but here's the process. Check with your parents or others that have gone through. But, you know, here's how it works. Here's just some information. And I know that initially they're not calmed many times, but it's the best that I can do. And yet that's the most that I can do. Sure.
I know a little bit about grief. Good grief. But
Charlie Brown. Well, again, it's unfortunate, but sometimes the baggage that people have or that they put on themselves are sort of related in this spiritual realm. That's not necessary.
But that's how I look at it with my dad. I mean, honestly, I cried one time, and that was before he passed away. And I don't think I'm a bad kid. I love my dad, but it was just a different experience that my brothers and I had compared with our mom. And maybe that's something to be grateful for, because I know I'm going to see my dad again. And I know that he continues to have influence on my life, and I don't know what it means to be dead and where things are spiritually in the grand cause. You know, I mean, I don't know how that's operationally possible, but, you know, I'm grateful for that. And there is a real joy that we can have, that at the bottom line is our hope is built. You know, I'll refer back to that. Isn't that a good pastoral ending? You know, just through the exclamation point. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus Christ and his righteousness. And so in all these areas, we do have that comfort. We don't have to have all the answers. But there are many gestures we can do to just help each other out a great deal. And with that, should I ask to take up the offering or something again? I mean, that, what kind? I'm out of here. If you're not going to take up an offering, this has just been. But thank you again for the opportunity to be here and talk with you.
Why don't we thank?